Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband, Abram, also to be his wife. And he went in unto Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. And Sarai said unto Abram, My wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid unto thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. And the angel of the Lord found Hagar, and said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael. And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me, and be thou perfect. And I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations will I make thee. And I will make thee exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. And God said unto Abraham, As for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. And I will bless her, and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her. Then Abraham fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, Shall a child be born unto him that is nearly 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years, bear one? And Abraham said unto God, O that Ishmael might live before thee. And God said, Sarah thy wife shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make of him a great nation. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. Sarah conceived, and bare Abraham a son in their old age, at the set time of which God had spoken. And Abraham called the name of his son, whom Sarah bare, Isaac. And Sarah saw that the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abraham, Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this woman shall not be heir with my son, equal with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his sons. And God said unto Abraham, Let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad and because of thy bondwoman. In all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And of the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is also thy seed. And Abraham rose up early in the morning and took bread and a bottle of water and gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder and the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs, and they wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called unto Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, "What aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thine hand, for I will make of him a great nation." And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went, filled the bottle, and gave them both drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness. So is it written. Good morning. My thanks to Reverend Van Zandt and the worship team for the very gracious invitation, and to all of you for getting your clocks right so that you could stop by. It's a special personal pleasure to visit with you, this historic congregation and city. My wife Phyllis and I are longtime friends with the Reverend Robert Tapscott, founder and lifetime president of the Elijah Parish Lovejoy Society, of which we've been proud members. This Saturday marks Lovejoy's 211th birthday. This Thursday, my own birthday, is also the 176th anniversary of his death, of course, here in Alton. In 2002, the bicentennial year of Lovejoy's birth, I received one of the greatest honors of my professional life, the Lovejoy Society's National Education Award, voted to the American educator whose actions have been thought to best reflect Elijah Lovejoy's commitment to free speech. Over the years, my family and I have made a number of visits to the Lovejoy Monument, the first time also to see the Piasaw bird. Of course, at that point, I thought it had been painted by an obscure Italian, and I was calling it the Piazza bird. So these are all reasons helping to explain why Alton, Lovejoy, and I have had a more than ordinary connection. It's wonderful to be here with you. The reading was excerpted from Genesis 16:21, telling us who is the Old Testament Ishmael. So what use did Herman Melville make of him in his masterpiece Moby Dick, and why should we care? Ishmael is the son of Abraham and Hagar, the Egyptian servant of Abraham's wife Sarah. When Hagar bears Abraham's child, she grows arrogant toward the childless Sarah. But 13 years later, when Sarah, at the remarkable age of 90, bears a son, Isaac, of her 100-year-old husband, one might incidentally just imagine the late-night conversations months before of this couple in their tent. "Oh, Abe, you've been talking with that angel again, and this time he told you what?" Sarah, now seized by jealousy, persuades Abraham to cast the pair out into the wilderness with no more than a water bottle and a box lunch, fulfilling the prophecy from the child's birth, "And he will be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him." Alone in the desert, Hagar and her teenage son are soon dying of thirst when an angel of the Lord appears, creating a well to save them. Ishmael grows to manhood, marries, and has 12 sons from whom the Arab nations claim descent. What lesson is being urged here other than that Arabs and the children of Israel are brothers and sisters, siblings by the same father? "Give me a fish, and I will eat for today. Teach me to fish, and I eat for a lifetime." I know that sounds vaguely biblical, but it's the proverb used as the epigram for ex-priest Richard Bowles's 40-plus years bestseller on job hunting, "What Color Is Your Parachute?" Is the message, then, about fishing, eating, or living, or perhaps all three? These questions seem to me particularly fitting with central themes from two great works I want to explore with you this morning, Moby Dick and the Book of Jonah, what I'm calling Wailing Stories for Our Time. Let me start with Melville's novel, arguably the most interesting ever written by an American, termed by no less a critic than D.H. Lawrence, as you can see atop the order of service, a great book, a very great book, the greatest book of the sea ever written. It moves awe in the soul. The story is purportedly told by Ishmael, an engaging narrator who, as we meet him, says that when he gets depressed, bad-mouthing people and circumstances around him like a real isolado, he goes to sea. As the book opens, this New York City native travels to New Bedford, Massachusetts, looking for a whaler on which to sail, where he meets and is befriended by Queequeg, a huge South Seas islander, a tattooed cannibal and harpooner who had once been a prince in his native Pacific society. The ship on which they sign together is the Pequod, commanded by one Captain Ahab, a fearsomely crazed man obsessed with gaining revenge on the giant white sperm whale, Moby Dick, which some months earlier had torn off Ahab's leg after capsizing the small boat from which Ahab had led the chase. At the story's riveting climax, the revered critic F.O. Matheson termed it the finest piece of dramatic writing in American literature. He may be right, though I've always been partial to the scene of Melanie having her baby while Atlanta burns in Gone with the Wind. Ahab, standing at the prow of a harpooner's boat, fires his lance at Moby Dick, striking home. But as the great white whale dives, Ahab becomes entangled in the attached line and is instantly pulled to his death. Now, as if returning his attention to finish this scene of carnage, Moby Dick breaches, turns, bears down, and staves the Pequod, striking it broadside, sinking and killing all aboard but Ishmael, miraculously saved by Queequeg's airtight coffin, which the harpooner had commissioned of the ship's carpenter in a premonition of the catastrophe, and which now floats to the surface, holding him up as a life buoy. When Melville began his professional writing career, it was a time of great material optimism in America. Western migration was in full swing, fueled both by the discovery of gold in California outside Sacramento in January 1848, and by ongoing industrialization, such as the work on a vastly improved transportation network permitting freer movement of people and of goods. One of its major components ran almost by our backyards, the Cumberland Trail, begun in Maryland, terminating at the early Illinois capital of Vandalia, where the young Abraham Lincoln served in the state legislature and where his desk is still on display in the old state house. Feeder roads continued onto St. Louis on the way to Denver and the Rocky Mountains. Today I'm describing, of course, Interstate 70, paved in many spots directly over the original Cumberland Trail. As new American commercial vistas opened, important developments were taking place at sea. Americans are, quote, destined by nature to be great maritime people, wrote one distinguished foreign visitor in the early 1830s, born to rule the seas as Romans were to conquer the ancient world. The visitor was the young French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville, who in 1835 would publish his account of travels here and predictions about our national future, which have proven true with jaw-dropping accuracy, in part one of his landmark study, Democracy in America. Our material progress, however, wasn't matched by either cultural accomplishment or artistic recognition. With wholly characteristic arrogance, the British critic Sidney Smith wrote in 1820, "In all the four corners of the globe, who today reads an American book?" And at the time, Smith was right. Herman Melville helped to change that fact, but it was a notably slow process. To begin with, he wasn't part of the prevalent mid-19th century capitalistic tradition of expansionist American optimism. The reasons are complicated, deeply embedded in the fabrics of his life and art. Melville's first two novels, based on his adventures as a sailor encountering cannibal natives in the South Pacific, were instant bestsellers. Everybody read them. If Oprah had been on the air in 1847, 1848, Melville would surely have been her guest. And Typee, A Peep at Polynesian Life, his first publication, might have been her book club choice. But almost as quickly as he had become famous, Melville lost his popular audience by refusing to turn out requested sequels to his early work. His major writing was done by 1857 when he was only 38. From soon after the Civil War, for almost 20 years, he worked as a customs clerk in New York City, quite forgotten. In 1876, as part of the World's Fair centennial celebrations in Philadelphia, all America's most important writers were invited to attend, not Melville. As it apparently didn't occur to the planners that he was still alive, no invitation was prepared. He lived on to 1891, at age 72, by 19th century standards, almost a double lifetime. At his death, a New York newspaper obituary noted the passing of that once famous novelist, Hiram Melville. He remained a largely ignored figure until the 1920s, when the great Melville revival began. To say it's flourished since would be a little like calling Niagara a waterfall. So much scholarship on the subject has been produced that the American critic Harry Levin once suggested that writing about Herman Melville has replaced whaling as New England's leading industry. Melville had little of the aloof, detached perspective of his friend Nathaniel Hawthorne, nor the optimism of Ralph Waldo Emerson. He searched and seemed unable to discover a philosophical or religious synthesis in which he could believe, a not altogether surprising result, considering his inherited background. His mother's family were the Gansevoorts of Albany, New York. She was raised in the Dutch Reformed Church, a strict observer of Calvinist doctrine, with all its beliefs in innate depravity, predestination, and original sin. His father, Alan, was a Boston Melville, committed Unitarians all, whose optimistic religious beliefs centered on reason rather than fear and trust in a benevolent God who, as Alan once wrote to his family while on a business trip, reconciles partial evil with universal good. Well, what dinner conversations this family must have had. And out of this rich spiritual mix, and as commentator Richard Chase puts it, Melville became a kind of alien wanderer in a world of imagination, seeking a truth that should be at once a truth of reason and a truth of art. Melville came to believe that we live in an insolubly dualistic world, forever caught between eternal and self-contained opposites, good and evil, heaven and hell, God and Satan, head and heart, spirit and matter. It was a perspective which helped fuel Melville's natural tendencies toward skepticism and doubt, but instead of being crushed by that conclusion, resourceful person that he was, Melville at mid-career renegotiated the terms of his art, determined to portray the denial of those easy affirmations by which most of us live. The test of a first-rate intelligence, wrote F. Scott Fitzgerald, is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in the mind at the same time and still function. Melville decided nothing less than to expose the uncertainties, the contradictions, the unanswerable riddles of life, which most of us prefer to ignore. As famed psychologist and Melville scholar Henry Murray writes, Melville began to write not to soothe, but to kindle, to make people leap from their seats and fight for their lives. Melville's search and struggle to do so is a thrilling story, nowhere more evident than in Moby Dick. Melville grew, in other words, from an entertainer into an artist who realized that his work was destined not to console or sustain, but to disturb. And by dramatizing that most unwelcome truth of the human condition, our common vulnerability. And so in roundabout fashion, we arrive at the story of Jonah, mentioned several times in Moby Dick as a kind of cultural reference point. We often associate his name with someone who brings bad luck, But that's because we don't remember or don't probe more deeply the kind of parable which Jesus was so fond of citing. Too often, all we remember of Jonah is that he throws himself into the sea, is swallowed whole by a whale, then regurgitated 3 days later, remarkably enough, with all body parts still intact. But there's considerably more here for the asking. In the beginning, Jonah is told by divine message to go to Nineveh to preach the word of the one and only God to the pagans, to ask them to forsake their idolatry and be saved. But Jonah balks. He refuses because he doesn't want them to be saved. He wants them destroyed. As a loyal nationalist, he looks on Nineveh as his country's deadliest enemy. But the book of Jonah is a repudiation of this narrow mindset, as columnist Sidney J. Harris has suggested. It is instead a powerful denial of the cultist tendencies of those Israelites who believed that God's grace was limited to the children of Abraham, the children of Isaac, to be sure. Nineveh is spared in spite of Jonah as a lesson for him and us in divine compassion, regardless of any denominational belief, ethnic identification, or line of descent. The whole purpose of this miracle myth, as Harris and others read it, is to show that God extends his mercy and grace even to the enemies of Israel, that he is not a God of a tribe or cult, but of the whole universe. And this is the point that Jonah finds so hard to accept, believing as he does that the Lord should be on the side only of his own people. This is the core ecumenical meaning of the story, which really has not a hill of beans worth to do with Jonah bringing bad luck or whether a man might live inside a whale belly yet escape in one piece. It's a highly prophetic, mystical narrative because it moves the God of ancient Israel upward from a nationalistic deity to a universal one in a direct line of all the great Old Testament prophets. It's a message, then, not of vengeance or of disobedience, but of insight and of light. When I teach Moby Dick, I want to highlight Melville's rejection of many mid-19th century American perspectives, turning away, as he does, from any single-minded view of reality in favor of one more forked, ambiguous, and inclusive. Two chapters of the novel memorably illustrate this point. In the first, Ishmael is assigned as lookout from the ship's masthead, a tiny 4-square-foot open area 150 feet above the deck. Looking out at the transcendent beauty of the view of the calm sky and sea, he almost forgets how small and fragile is his perch. One false step, one overly enthusiastic admiration of the scenery, he says, and he plunges 15 stories to his death. In the second, Ishmael nearly wrecks the Pequod after having described in close detail the ship's kiln in which whale blubber is boiled to extract its precious oil, with all its associations of hellfire. Ishmael dozes off at the helm at the ship's wheel, only to be startled awake by the sense of something fatally wrong. In the moment before he regains his bearings, realizing that he's turned in his sleep to face the ship's stern rather than its bow, the Pequod seems, he says, not so much bound to any haven ahead as rushing from all havens astern. It's an experience which prompts the following brief sermon, one of the story's strongest judgments and condemnations of Ahab. Look not too long into the face of fire, O man. Never dream with thy hand on the helm. Give not thyself up then to fire, lest it invert thee, deaden thee, as for a time it did me. There is a wisdom that is woe, but there is a woe that is madness. Alone among the members of the Pequod, Ishmael sustains a perspective sufficiently large and flexible to grasp the limitations of both extremes. External reality rarely admits to either unblemished beauty or purifying fire. To survive, one needs to recognize and seize middle ground, to understand the limitations of both polar opposites. To covet either transcendental purity or blind rage is to invite madness and death. Ishmael survives the wreck of the Pequod, escaped alone to tell thee, as he puts it on the novel's last page, because just like Job, he has been tested and found worthy. He survives because he deserves to. In the same vein, I like asking students about the book's famed first sentence, perhaps the most famous opening line in all American literature. I ask if we may paraphrase it accurately as, "My name is Ishmael." And a surprising number of folks often agree, as if I just asked who's buried in Grant's tomb. But I insist that the narrator is not directly identifying himself. Ishmael is not his name, but he tells us we may call him that. To a generation of readers brought up with close Bible study, the Genesis account of the teenage outcast condemned by God to live apart with his mother from the only society he has known, a wild man whose hand will be against every man and every man's hand against him, would seem both familiar and appropriate to the misanthropy with which the narrator begins his story. Our Ishmael, though, whatever his real name, grows beyond such a stance, accepts as a chaste bedmate and brother a tattooed cannibal, and from him learns all the redeeming Judeo-Christian virtues of friendship, community, forgiveness, acceptance, love. Alone at sea, where the tranquil beauty and brilliance of the ocean skin but conceals the tiger heart that beats beneath it, as Ishmael says, such lessons prove a lifeline. Each year, many of us receive solicitations from a unique New York City-based charity, the Abraham Fund, which Phyllis and I are pleased to support, dedicated as it is both to underwriting programs to promote Arab and Jewish mutual understanding and educational collaboration, and to honor the Old Testament patriarch who fathers both Ishmael and Isaac. At the signing of the historic 1998 West Bank Agreement, mediated by President Clinton between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization, Jordan's King Hussein delivered the following poignant elegy to the effort. "There has been enough destruction, enough death, enough waste. It's time that together we occupy a place beyond ourselves, our peoples, that is worthy of them and of their sons and their daughters, the descendants of the children of Abraham." There is in Jewish folklore the tradition of tikkun olam, roughly translatable as the urge to heal the world. To the extent American author Bernard Malamud was right to suggest, all of us are Jews, but few of us know it. To be a Jew today is to know, in commentator Leonard Fine's words, that our world is not working the way it was intended. Rather, it's badly broken, and we are all implicated in its repair. While I'm not here to suggest that Moby Dick is a profoundly Jewish book, I will say that when we vicariously experience the world of the Pequod, a microcosmic society carefully populated by members of almost every imaginable ethnic and religious group, obviously intended by Melville to represent all humanity, with the glaring omission, of course, of the half of it who are women, we see that the world is broken, streaked as it is by vengeance, greed, selfishness, spiritual weakness, and interpersonal neglect. When Ishmael turns away from this worldview, when he successfully resists Ahab's magnetic but neurotic illusions of self-dependence, he's illustrating Melville's rejection of what he came to see as the ruinous individualism of optimistic, expansionistic mid-19th century America. By reconciling the contrary beliefs he encounters, Ishmael is one of our first anti-heroes, one of the first modern figures to express a fuller, more balanced vision by which to order one's life. Is it really too much to suggest it became a goal of his author to do the same? So, Jonah, Ishmael, Melville. Three fishing stories of a sort, but about fish, food, or quality of life. The educator Patricia Cross has paraphrased Richard Bowles in referencing the ongoing debate over the relative value of vocational or pre-professional study versus that of the traditional liberal arts. Teach students subject matter, she says, and you give them perishable information. Teach them how to learn, and you give them knowledge and independence for the rest of their lives. The message is that learning to learn transcends age and location. If it's never too late to learn, neither is it to draw upon the core Judeo-Christian values learned by Jonah and Ishmael of compassion, altruism, justice, and trust. May the fish each of us seek provide not only today's food, but a lifetime nourishment for thought. And may such presence inform each of our lives, which the peace which brings and passes understanding. Amen.